Okay, good morning, guys. Okay, so just to recap quickly what we said yesterday, we're in the middle of this analysis of Rabbi Akiva's statement.
Yeah.
Rabbi Akiva said that when witnesses confess, that's another exception to the rule that they pay the reciprocal penalty. They don't pay the reciprocal penalty. However, we eventually got to this point here. Oh, actually, we'll just wait till the next line. Fine. So we had a vague statement from Rav Yehuda Amar Rav that we were in the middle of trying to figure out what he meant. Rav Yehuda Amar Rav said that a eid zomem, a false witness, pays according to his share. Right? That was his vague statement we were trying to figure out. The first attempt we had to figure out what he meant was that each guy pays half. Right? Each guy pays his share. Right. And we said, that's actually true, but that can't be what Rav Yehuda Amar Rav meant because we have a Mishnah already that says so explicitly. The second attempt we had to explain it was that if only one of them is falsified, then he pays his share and the other guy doesn't pay anything. We said, well, that also can't be because that's not true. That's actually not true. That you need to falsify the entire set, however large it may be, as we discussed, in order to make any of them actually have to pay. Next try. We're up to nine lines down approximately on the page. The first words on the line is Amar Rava. I have it up on the screen too. Amar Rava. Rava says, what's this case of the false witness pays according to his share? But Omer Edus Sheker Hayati, when the guy comes and says, I testified falsely. So he comes and admits. So this is seemingly what Rabbi Akiva was talking about, right? That the guy comes and admits. And in that case, we say that he pays his share. The Gemara says, no, that's also not right. That can't be either, right? He doesn't pay his share there either. Why? Because the Gemara says, Kol Kamine, is it in his power to do so, meaning to alter his testimony? Kivan Shehigid Shuve no Choseru Magid. Once he's already come and spoken and given his testimony, he is not able, he is not eligible to alter his testimony in any way.
Again, this,
pardon me?
You can't take it back.
You can't take it back. No backsies. Which means his original testimony stands, and the defendant on trial will have to pay. Now, the commentaries here add in a very interesting point, is that they say that really, this isn't to say that the false witness who admitted is going to get off scot-free. He's actually going to have to pay the guy back. It's just that we don't apply the reciprocal punishment to him. But if it's a monetary case, he's going to have to pay the defendant back for what he cost him because he admitted, which essentially obligates himself to say, I am going to cover this one, right? It's on me. Now, he would only have to pay his half. His co-witness wouldn't have to pay anything because he didn't admit to anything. The whole point here is we don't accept his new testimony as a testimony. All we accept it as an obligation for himself to have to commit to paying back, right? But it doesn't change the testimony at all, right? And therefore,
this one way or the other. Why would he confess?
It just can't be that the false witness pay. Well, he has to pay one way or the other. What do you mean? He wouldn't pay if he didn't confess. The defendant would pay. Now the false witness confesses, so the defendant has to pay because the false witness is. Correction didn't do anything, so the defendant still has to pay, but the false witness who admitted will have to reimburse the guy, not because of a testimony. This is not like a technical rule in courts. It's not a testimony rule. It's just a rule that that witness who admitted obligates himself to reimburse by saying, I really owe you this money because it's because of me that you're here. Yeah. But it's not that he's altering his testimony. It's sort of a technical detail. But the point is this can't be what he's talking about, that a false witness pays according to his share. Because he's not paying his share of anything to do with false witnessing. No. It's just a side rule that he's going to obligate himself to have to reimburse. So again, we still haven't figured out what it is that the statement meant, a false witness pays according to his share. We haven't figured that out. Okay, we're going to get there right now, trust me. We're almost there. Next try. Ella, rather, what happened? But Omer Heyadnu Vehuzamnu Bebeistin. So what they say is, and we touched on this yesterday, is they say, we testified in Tel Aviv, right? We accused Ploni in Tel Aviv. Vehuzamnu Bebeistin, and we were falsified in that court, meaning a second set of witnesses came and said that we were lying. Mm-hmm. Then we fled the scene, right? Then we escaped to Jerusalem. And they had then came to the Jerusalem court and said, what happened? So that's basically what they're saying. They're saying we were testifying in Tel Aviv and we were falsified over there in Tel Aviv. The Gemara says they still don't have to pay, right? Why do they still not have to pay? Kiman, whose opinion would this be like if they would have to pay? I mean, who says they would have to pay here if they came and confessed that they were falsified in another court? De lo ki Rabbi Akiva. That's not Rabbi Akiva. So now we finally understand why we brought this whole thing up, is because we're going to finally figure out what Rabbi Akiva was talking about when he said the false witnesses don't pay based on their own confession. Meaning the Rabbi Akiva, because if this would jive with Rabbi Akiva, it can't be Ha'amar, because Rabbi Akiva said, Af eno mishal mal piatzmo. The false witnesses don't pay based on their own confession. Which means, this is the case that Rabbi Akiva was talking about. Right? And that's how Rashi knew on the previous page, like I told you. This is the case Rabbi Akiva was talking about when he says a false witness does not pay based on his own confession. It means that when he got falsified in one court, fled to another court, and confessed over there, he does not pay the reciprocal penalty for that. He does not pay. This is Rabbi Akiva's din, as we mentioned yesterday, called Moda Beknas, somebody who admits to a fine. If you admit to a compensation punishment that Beis Din obligated you, yeah, your admission obligates you to pay. But if you admit to a fine that Beis Din obligated you to pay, you don't pay, right? You don't pay. And that is what Rabbi Akiva's point is over here, that I'm just admitting that I got falsified in that previous court. I'm admitting to a fine that I should be liable from the fact that I got falsified in that previous court. However, in this case, what he's saying is that we never really got convicted of anything in that previous court. The only thing that happened was that we got falsified. The Beis Din over there never ruled on the final judgment of what should be happening to us as witnesses. They just accepted the testimony of the second witnesses over ours, which essentially falsified us. That's what they're coming to say in the new Beis Din. In that case, they don't pay based on their own admission because it's admitting to a fine. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that is the case of Rabbi Akiva. But so now we understand what Rabbi Akiva is talking about, but we still haven't understood our vague statement that we're trying to figure out, that a false witness pays according to his share, because he's not going to pay based on this confession because he's admitting to a fine and he's not admitting to a compensation. So last try, now we finally hit the money. Ella, rather, what did Rabbi Yehuda Marab mean when he said a false witness pays according to his share? Ella, rather, he means as follows. Be'omer, the witness says, Heyadnu vehuzamnu bebeistin ploni. It starts the same way. We were in Tel Aviv, we testified there, and we were falsified in Tel Aviv. However, vehuyavnu mamon, and the beistin in Tel Aviv ruled that we owe money. The whole trial there in Tel Aviv was totally finished. Everything was over, and then we fled. So now when they come to Jerusalem and confess, what are they confessing to? They're not confessing to a fine anymore. They're confessing to money that Beis Din has already ruled that they owe. Once Beis Din has ruled that they owe the money, it's not considered like a fine anymore. It's considered a regular debt, right? Yeah. They just owe the money. That's all it is. It's a debt.
They skipped on it.
Right? And they skipped on their debt. And when a person confesses to skipping on his debt, that he has to pay. That he has to pay. That's confessing to owing money, not owing a fine. The fine is only, it's only called a fine when it's in the state of Beis Din has yet to rule on it. It's admitting to the ruling that the Torah would say is a fine for us. When they admit to that, they don't pay. But when they admit to a debt that they currently owe, it doesn't matter how they got to that debt, whether it was because it came to them as a fine or because it came to them as a compensation. The bottom line is they have a debt right now. And when they admit that they owe a debt that's been ruled and finalized and based in, that they're going to have to pay.
But they would have to pay it whether they admitted to it or not, because isn't that true?
Why? Well, how?
If you have a debt...
Well, they're now in Jerusalem, and no one knows
who they
are.
Ran away.
They're clearly, at this point, in the clear, right? They've fled the scene, right? There's nobody on their trail. There's nobody hot on their trail, right? They're in the clear, right? So nobody knows who they are right now. So the fact that he comes to Beis Din and says he owes it is admitting to a debt, right, that he owes, that nobody knows that he owes right now, right? So he's coming and admitting to a debt, and that admission would obligate you to pay. That type of admission would obligate you to have to pay. It's only in the stage before they were convicted in that previous court. They had only been falsified in that previous court. That's when they don't pay. That's Rabbi Akiva's case. But when they're admitting to the fact that they were already ruled on, then they're admitting to a debt. They do have to pay that debt. Now, let's say only one of the two witnesses comes to the Jerusalem court and admits that he owes a debt, and the other witness is still in Hawaii somewhere, right? He's living the good life, right? So so what happens then? So that is the case of Rav Yehuda Marav that says a false witness pays according to his share, that when one guy admits that he already owes a debt because he's been convicted in the previous court, so he pays his share, and the other guy, he can't obligate to pay based on his admission. Because again, it's just one person's admission that can't obligate his friend in this new court. Right? This new court knows none of the details of the facts. They're only saying you owe the money now because you admitted to it. The other guy, even though obviously if you owe money, he owes money too, we can't force the second guy to pay.
The court doesn't know about this.
Even case. If they do know, even if the other guy says, me and my friend Johnny,
oh, okay.
Right? This whole story happened in Tel Aviv. Even still, right? The court is never going to obligate that second guy to pay because the only reason they're obligating the first guy in the new city's court is because of his own admission. Right?
Yeah.
If we had two other fresh witnesses that says, we were also sitting there in the trial in Tel Aviv and we saw both these guys convicted there,
yeah.
So then that would make both of them have to pay. But the fact that it's only the admission of one party that is causing himself to pay, that's not going to cause his friend to pay, and that is a chiddush too, and that's how the Gemara speaks it. So let's read that inside. So the Gemara says...
Why would he do that? Why would the one that does...
He did tshuva.
The other one did.
Right. He's still in Hawaii enjoying life, right? Maybe when he comes back, he'll reconsider. He'll come to the posel, he'll see, right? He'll reconsider, right? Okay. So let's read that inside. Ella, rather, Be'omer he'adnu v'uzamnu based in Ploni, v'chu yavnu mamon. We already obligated a debt in that other based in Tel Aviv. Salka daita hamina. Why is this a novelty? Okay, this sounds obvious. He should have to pay. No. I might have thought, kiven de lechavre lo matzi mechayev le, since I can't obligate the other witness, his friend, right? And I can't obligate both of them to have to pay. Remember we saw before, you can't falsify witnesses until you falsified both of them, right? So wait, maybe here too, I would have thought I wouldn't accept one person's confession unless I get both confessions, and I won't make one guy pay unless I have to make both guy pays. That's what I would have thought. Therefore, this guy who's admitting right in front of me too shouldn't have to pay. Kamash Malan, no. That guy does have to pay in this case. When you admit to a debt, even we don't have to get the full admission from both parties.
Mm-hmm.
It's only for the falsification process that we need to falsify both parties. But once both have been falsified in another court, even if one guy admits to his debt, that we're going to make him pay. And that is what Rav Yehuda Amarav meant when he said a false witness pays according to his share. We solved the riddle, right? What does it mean? It means that they were both convicted in Tel Aviv. One guy admits in Jerusalem. He pays his share. The other guy pays nothing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we finished the analysis of the whole first Mishnah in Maseches Makos.
For us.
Mazel tov. Okay, now we start what may be the hardest Mishnah in the tractate. Okay, this is a very... If you'll notice, you just glance at your page. The Mishnah sounds like the regular size of a Mishnah, but the Gemara is 1.5 lines, right? But it is very, very tricky. Okay, so we have to get some facts and background before we start. It's going to be interesting because I feel like I'm going to start this and the rabbi is going to continue. So we have to see. Hopefully this will line up for this very, very difficult Mishnah. Okay, so the facts that we need as background are as follows. What are the different ways a marriage can end? A marriage can end in three ways. Death of who? Okay, but that's two different cases. Right? Well, death of the husband is one case.
Yeah.
Death of the wife is a second case. What was the third way?
Divorce.
Yeah. Divorce.
Yeah.
Right? That's the only ways marriage can end. Three ways, right? A marriage can end in three different ways. When a marriage begins, a husband is required and obligated to commit and commit himself to paying the ksuva payment, which let's just say is 200. Let's just use an easy number. That's a standard number. That says 200, right? So he's got to pay a ksuva of 200. Now, under which circumstances is he obligated to pay the ksuva, and under which circumstances is he not obligated to pay the ksuva? We have three ways the marriage can end. So when does he have to pay and when does he not have to pay?
In divorce.
He has to pay in divorce, correct?
Yeah.
That's it?
When he dies.
So it comes out of his estate. Right, it comes out of his estate to pay the ksuva that he owes her. When it comes. But if she passes away first, her estate receives nothing from the ksuva.
Yeah.
Right, she doesn't get any ksuva if he passes away first.
No.
If she passes away first,
for that.
There's many things that she can do to not get the ksuva anymore. Right?
Yes, we're not going into any of that stuff. Right, we're assuming she deserves her ksuva. Right? This lady didn't do anything to cost herself her ksuva. She would get her ksuva if it was one of the two marriage endings that she got a ksuva from. Another detail of the ksuva. Another important detail of the ksuva is... Just one second.
It's a shtar, right?
Yeah, it's a document. Just 1 second, I just want to... Right. Now, what if she dies first?
Mm-hmm.
Now, or back it up. There's other... Let's say a woman has property when she gets married. So what happens to that real property, like land, retail? No, right when they get married. What happens to the property right when they get married?
To the husband.
Kind of. She still owns the property. She doesn't lose ownership. She has the deed, right? She doesn't lose ownership over the property. The husband gets what's known as, excuse me, nechsei malug, which means plucking rights. Okay. Which means, essentially, he gets to use this property.
He's a landlord.
The whole time that they're married,
he
can, like, let's say it's a apple field. So he can eat, he has the rights to all the fruits the whole time they're married. But he doesn't own the land. She owns the land. He can do whatever he wants with the
fruit.
With the
use and enjoyment.
The usage and enjoyment. So very nice.
It's
right?
Like he's renting it without paying with rent.
Exactly. Right? He gets all the benefits of the land, but it's really hers. It's really hers, right? So what would happen if she dies first?
It goes back to her father.
It goes to her first heir. Who's her first heir?
Oh.
The husband. The husband is a wife's first heir. Right?
Oh.
Right. So the property would go to him, right? So there's really a benefit, a financial benefit, I should say, to each of the other parties dying first. If the wife dies first, the husband benefits in that he now receives the deed, right? He now owns the property. It's his property fully. He's inherited the property. Whereas if he dies first, the wife gets the ksuva. There's there's another kind of property a lady could come into the marriage with, and that's not called plucking property. It's called tzon barzel, right? Tzon barzel means iron sheep, right? Now, why do it's like what does this have to do with anything? The sheep, I'm still not even exactly sure what it means exactly. But the iron means is that the value cannot change. With the plucking property we talked about first, the plucking property, right? So let's say he receives the property at the beginning of the harvest season and it's full with apples on it. And then she dies right at the end of the harvest season after he's removed. Oh, sorry, he dies after he's removed everything from the field. So she just gets the field back the way it is. There's no like, it was worth 200 when you started it. Now it's only worth 100, so you have to make it even. Now, he had the right to do whatever he wanted with whatever was on it. She just owns the ground. It just comes back there however it is at the time. But there's a second option called this tzon barzel, which is he can still use the property while they're married, but the property returns back to her, if it ever does come back there, it would return back with the same value. So if it's worth less at the time, he has to pay to even out the numbers.
Is that
right?
A prenup?
Kind of, right? I mean, she'd have to include at the time of the ksuva, I want this land to be considered its own barzel land. I want it to be a fixed valued land that you'd have to reimburse exactly that value. Okay? So, again, all these lands would go right to the husband if she dies first, and the ksuva goes to her if either he dies first or the divorce. Mm-hmm. So there's two cases in which she benefits, one case in which he benefits. Whose benefit is greater?
His
is way greater, right? The ksuva value is significantly less than the value of any land. Right? Usually, I mean, it, there could be that she had no land, and then there wouldn't be relevant. But assuming the case where everyone gets all the potential perks they could get in this document, his perk would likely be worth more than her perk, right? Or it would be at a greater value, we should say, than her perk. Okay, so now we're ready with that introduction to at least begin the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, back to our false witnesses, the first two witnesses testify about a guy, Shigiresh's Ishto, that he divorced his wife. That's what they testify. He divorced his wife, but the lo nasan la ksuvasa, he never paid up the ksuva. Right? And the guy says, well, I never divorced her. Right? He says, I'm still married. Leave me alone. Right? That's what the guy, the defendant says. Right? He's not happy with this. Yeah. And now two more witnesses say, on that day you said you witnessed the divorce taking place, you were with us in Cancun. Yeah. Right? You were not available. You guys don't know what you're talking about, and therefore we falsify the first set of witnesses that the guy is actually married. He's not divorced. Okay. So this is an exceptional rule. We can't give these guys the reciprocal punishment, or we can. It's just going to be very difficult to figure out exactly what they cost, right? This is where we get into a problem. Right? What did they exactly cost this guy by saying you have to pay the ksuva today? Because in two out of three possible scenarios we discussed, he's going to have to pay it anyways, right? Mm-hmm. So true, they made him pay it today, where it might be earlier than he would have had to pay
it. Time value money difference.
So there's a time value here that he's going to have to pay earlier than he may have end up having to pay it eventually. But there's a second point that he actually may have never even had to pay this eventually.
Yeah, she may have gone
there's
first.
A one-third chance that he would have never even had to pay this eventually. So what are they costing the guy today? What were the false witnesses actually costing him today? How do you calculate that? Ksuba. But the ksuba he may have had to pay eventually.
Yeah. Nothing rough now.
Well, they're right now they're for sure costing him the time difference of paying today versus whatever I may have had to pay in the future. Yeah, yeah. And they're also costing that it's possible I would have never had to pay it in the future if the husband died first.
Yeah.
And if the wife died first. If the wife died first, I would have never had to pay it in the future. So A, it's a time, and B, there is a chance it would have never even happened altogether. There's a good chance it would, but there's also a decent chance it would have never even happened altogether.
What are all the fruit he could have plucked over all those years that could have, who knows?
Right, when? And now all the benefit to plucking the fruit in the meantime also, which you're trying to cost me right now too.
I'll give the ksuba later, just wait until your wife dies, ex-wife dies.
Yeah, but they were trying to cost him today. If they would have won the trial, if the false witnesses would have been successful, Basin would have ruled... Pay up.
So he
didn't have to pay up because they were falsified. Yeah. But now, what were they costing him? What exactly would they have cost him at that moment? What do we charge the false witnesses? Because they cost him time. Yeah. They cost him the potential. They cost him the plucking rights right now. But how do you calculate all that stuff? Right? This seems not simple to calculate. What we need to examine here are future options in the stock market. This is the best way to figure out what's going on over here. Right? So as you see, the Gemara was a little bit ahead of its time in economics too. Okay. So how do we figure this out? So let's just, the Gemara just says it vaguely. I mean, the mission just says it vaguely first. So it just says, Omdin, we assess. Oh, we assess it. Okay, we assess. Kama Adam Rotze, how much would another person be willing to, a third party, right? Random buyer, right? The stock market buyer. How much would he be willing, Liten Biksubasa Shalzu, to pay for this ksuva right now, today? How much would he be willing to invest in this risky proposition of buying the ksuva? She'im Nisalmana o Nisgarsha, that if she would become widowed or divorced, then she would get it. Then that side would win the contract. The imesa, but if she would die, Yershenabala, then her husband would inherit and he would win. So how much would a person be willing to get himself involved in this risk for? How much would you buy the rights to this deal? So how much would a person be willing to get? You have to go to the stock market and see how much is the right they're willing to gamble here.
I think, Rabbi, I think real estate is a better example than stock market. Because real estate is very obvious. It's whatever income potential it has in the future.
But there's a chance it could go to, I guess, if you, I like stock market because there's a greater chance things can be worth nothing at the end of the day, right? You may end up with nothing. There's a chance that the future options, the way they work is just a short little future options work is, let's say a stock is worth $50, so I think it's going to be worth more than $60 next month. So I buy an option that it should be worth $60. If it's worth $60, I get to buy it at $60 next month, and it could be worth $80. Yeah. And I get to buy it at $60 right then, and then sell it immediately and just cash in.
Yeah.
Right? But if it's worth $55, I don't get to buy anything, and I just wasted my whole investment in the future option. Right? Well, so this is, it's much more like future options the way I see it.
The calculation is based on like an actuarial calculation of who's going to die. And
all this stuff. Right. So that's what the guy who's buying has to sit there with his, he's going to go algorithms and whatever math he needs to know to figure out.
Why
would who bother? A third party? Maybe it's a good investment. Yes. I'm getting value on this. Somebody says I get value on this. I think this contract is worth 50, and maybe I'll make an offer for 30. If I get it, it's really worth it for me because maybe I'll lose the 30, but
so
this is a good investment for me.
Who's going to sell it?
Good question. This is the problem. What is he buying? What is this third party buying? Whose rights are he buying? What exactly is he buying?
Not divorced. Huh? His wife's not even divorced.
No, that's for sure.
Oh, right.
The question is now, is he saying, nothing is changing, but how much would a person be willing to buy that contract for right now? Good question. That's what the Gemara wants to know. But what are you buying? Whose rights are you buying? You're buying the husband's rights. You're buying the wife's rights. What rights are you buying here that
you don't know what's
that
would...
Well, there's a debate here, so we have to see all the sides. We're going to have to get, this is why it's kind of, there's three options, really, which you think, what's the third option already, right? There's the husband's right and the wife's right. Right, what's the third option? Right? We have to see all the different options.
Can I clarify something?
Yeah, please.
So, is there the wife can take her ksuva and go on the market and sell it?
Yeah,
so
sure.
Market.
Why would she
sell it to the husband? Maybe she wants money now.
It's worth it.
Maybe she wants some cash. There's a value to the ksuva. There's a value to the ksuva. Some people would rather have cash money than future value, right? People
can has no say in that.
No. Well, what does he care?
It's based in rules.
He's going to have to pay it eventually.
Yes, married to you.
Yes,
you
but
selling the thing?
Because she wants money. He can say, to him, it's, I'm going to have to pay.
Buy it.
There's two cases where I'm going to have to, that's also an option too. She can offer to sell it to him. And what one assumption we're going to see later with the third explanation is almost any husband would be willing to do this at any time, is buy his wife's ksuba back from him
right.
for the price that the third right. party would be willing to do it. It's almost always worth it for the husband to do this,
right?
Right? Yeah. Financially. For the husband, it's for sure worth it to do it. For a third party, they have to figure out...
He's not planning to divorce there.
No, but that's irrelevant. Yeah. Maybe he's going to die. It's right. not just divorce. He could just die first, and then he'll save a lot on his heirs, and his estate
Once
will get
dead,
a lot
what
more.
Do you care?
What do you mean? He's got a. People care about all kinds of things. I don't know why this guy cares, but I'll.
Just
care.
A question. Like, if he's buys back to Tuva, doesn't that, like, renege all the obligations he has to her?
No, that he wouldn't have to do. Just he still has to keep all those obligations.
Okay.
If a third party buys the ksuba, it doesn't mean he has to provide food and clothes for the right for the stock market purchaser, right? And I didn't even mention the third requirement,
yeah.
right? right? It certainly is not remove
fine.
His obligations towards
okay.
his wife. All he's doing is saying what will be the future results of this relationship.
Okay.
What is the financial
okay.
when this relationship dissolves at whatever point? Mm-hmm. How does the finances work out? Right? Okay. So that is the Mishnah. Okay, so the Mishnah basically just says vaguely that we use this future option system to assess how to make them pay back. So what we're saying here is this is actually not an exception to the rule. They are paying reciprocal punishment. It's just really hard to calculate what it is, right? That's what the issue over here is. So what do? We use the third-party stock market system to calculate what the value of the ksuv is right now. Whose value? That's what we're starting right now. Okay, so the Gemara says, Ketzad Shamin, how do we assess? Right. What is the assessment that we're using? First answer is the most simple, I think. Amar Rav Chista. Rav Chista says, Biba'al, the husband's rights. Right? That's what they were trying to cost, the false witnesses. They were trying to cost him his rights in the ksuva right now. He was going to lose his plucking rights. He was going to have to pay it right now. He was losing all of his benefits in the ksuva immediately.
Immediately, right now.
Right now. Yeah, right? He's going to lose it all right away. Right? That's what they were trying to cost him. So what do we assess? How much another person would be willing to pay for his rights right
yeah.
now?
Yeah.
What are his rights worth? Right? Somebody else right. is going to say, I'm willing to, let's say the ksuva total was 200. Somebody else says, I'm willing to pay $100, right, to risk it, that maybe she's going to die first and I'll get nothing. Excuse me, maybe you're going to die first. Yeah. Or maybe or you're going to divorce her even, and I'm going to get... Nothing. I'm going to lose everything, mm-hmm. right? You're going to have to give everything to this lady.
He can't sell it because...
He could sell his rights. He's not going to get rid of the property. No. He doesn't sell the property. Maybe he could sell the plucking rights, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But he doesn't sell the land, right?
He could
sell all of his rights if he wanted, right? He could sell the plucking rights to his to what
but
he has rights to right now. If they would have succeeded in testing, he would have lost everything right now.
Yeah, the false...
Not to him, not to them.
For his...
To her.
Right.
Sure there is. Because what's his rights? He gets the benefit of plucking right now until anything happens.
The false witness.
So somebody else would say, I want to buy your ksuva's worth $200. Maybe I'm willing to pay you $100. I may have to pay out $200 eventually. But in the meantime, I'm going to get the plucking rights on this field. Right. That might be worth it. Right?
Right.
Whatever it is, we're not talking dollars. These are much bigger sums, right? If you're talking about these like zoos or whatever, this could be much more. Say it's $1,000, right? It's like I'm willing to pay $1,000, even though I may have to pay $2,000 tomorrow. It could be tonight she's gonna die. He's gonna die. I'm gonna have to pay it tonight. I get no plucking, right?
Yeah.
It could be I'm gonna lose everything right away, and I get absolutely no benefit. Or it could be I get plucking rights for 50 years, right? And then I'm gonna have to pay half the ksuva. Could be a good deal. Could be a bad deal. Right. Whatever the guy thinks it's worth it, that is the amount that this guy lost, that the husband lost. At that moment.
Yes, so Rabbi, exactly.
But
so
you can buy the plucking, right?
Sure you could.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
you
the
can
whole
buy
point.
It from the husband.
That's right.
Right.
The ksuva doesn't give you...
How... Plucking. You're right. The ksuva gives the husband the right to use the... To have plucking rights.
Yeah, okay.
Now, the husband has rights that emerge to him out of the ksuva. He has plucking rights.
Out of being married.
Out of being... Well, that comes as a result of the ksuva, because whatever properties are written down in the ksuva that she has.
Uh-huh.
Right? So that is... It's all included.
Properties are
written. Yeah. We don't do it like
yeah,
this.
Yeah,
today, right? But that's in theory how it works, right? So the ksuva gives him the rights to use the property now,
right.
And it gives her the right that when he dies or divorces, he's going to have to pay the value of the ksuva to her. So everyone has a right in this document right now. So how much would somebody pay for his rights in the ksuva, right? Right now, I mean, you get this to use this property benefit right now. How much would somebody be willing to pay for that right now? It's a good value right now.
Yeah.
Right? Another, there's really two reasons why his rights are better than her rights. One reason that you said was that he gets plucking rights, right? That seems to be a greater value than maybe whatever the total value of the ksuva she's going to get. But there's a second benefit, too, is that his rights he enjoys right now. Her rights she's only going to enjoy in some potential future time. She may never get her rights. Mm-hmm. He for sure gets some rights right now, right? There's another reason why his rights are more valuable is because there's a value to them at this given, at this right at this moment, whereas her rights are not going to kick in, maybe ever, but for sure not until certain time elapses. So
the wife is selling it for her benefit right now. That's what she's doing. Is that it?
She's selling it. She didn't sell anything. What we're saying now is...
Who is this guy buying from?
The third party is going to the husband and saying, how much will you sell me your rights in the ksuva for? Yeah.
So it's from the husband he's buying.
No one's actually buying anything. We're saying, how much would a person be willing to buy this for? Right? That's all we're saying. Whatever a third party would be willing to buy this rights from the husband for, that's what the false witnesses are going to owe because that's what they were costing him right now.
Right. So to answer Steve's question, what I'm hearing... Why are they doing this? The false witnesses see the futures in this apple picking going up. So that's what they're betting on. They're saying, the apple orchard's getting...
Maybe it's no harvest. It's already after the harvest season, and they're going to plant the seeds, and it's going to make the whole field, right?
They're going to find a way, because they can't buy it right now, so they're going to try to put it into the market and buy it forward. They're going to pay, I'll pay you now for it, because they know it's going to be worth a lot more.
That's
what
they're
witnesses. No. Like this. There's nobody actually buying the husband's rights. No one's actually buying them.
Yeah.
All we're saying is how much do the witnesses pay? The amount that somebody would be willing to pay for the husband's rights. Where's a hypothetical case, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How much would somebody... It's just teaching us how much the value is on the rights. What are the value of the rights of the husband? How do you figure that out? Well, how much would somebody be willing to buy them for me now?
Okay.
So we figure out what the husband's rights are. However, some theoretical, hypothetical person would be willing to buy that for, that's how much the false witnesses have to pay, because that's what they were trying and about to cost him right now. Okay, we'll stop here, guys. There's two more explanations on how to calculate this amount, but we'll save that for Rav on Monday.